Chapter 9. The door chimes rang. Junie Black dropped her magazine and got up to answer it.
"A telegram for Mr. William Black,"
the uniformed Western Union boy said. "Sign here, please." He handed her a pencil and pad. She signed and received the telegram. Closing the door, she carried the telegram to her husband.
"For you," she said.
Bill Black opened the telegram, turned away so that his wife couldn't read it over his shoulder, and saw what it had to say. "Cycle missed truck. Gum past barbecue. Your guess." "Never send a boy to do a man's job," Bill Black said to himself. "Your guess is as good as mine." He glanced at his wristwatch. 9:30 p.m. Later and later. It was too late now.
"What's it say?"
Junie asked.
"Nothing,"
he said. "I wonder if they'll find him," he wondered.
"I hope so, because if they don't, some of us will be dead by this time tomorrow. God knows how many thousands of dead people. Our lives depend on Regal Gum, him and his contest."
"It's a catastrophe," Junie said, "isn't it? I can tell by the expression on your face."
"Business," he said. "City business."
"Oh, indeed," she said. "Don't lie to me. I'll bet it has something to do with Regal."
Suddenly, she snatched the telegram away from him and rushed out of the room with it.
"It is,"
she cried, standing off by herself and reading the telegram.
"What did you do? Hire somebody to kill him? I know he's disappeared. I was talking to Margot on the phone, and she says..."
He managed to get the telegram back from her.
"You haven't got any idea what this means," he said with mighty control.
"I can tell what it means. As soon as Margot told me Regal had disappeared..."
"Regal didn't disappear,"
he said, almost at the end of his mighty control.
"He walked off."
"How do you know?"
"I know," he said.
"You know because you're responsible for his disappearance."
In a sense, Bill Black thought, she's right. "I'm responsible because when he and Vic popped out of that clubhouse, I thought they were kidding."
"Okay," he said. "I'm responsible."
Her eyes changed color. The pupils became tiny.
"Oh, I hate you,"
she said, shaking her head.
"I wish I could slit your throat."
"Go ahead," he said. "Maybe it would be a good idea."
"I'm going next door," Junie said.
"Why?"
"I'm going to tell Vic and Margot that you're responsible."
She hurried to the front door. He went after her and caught hold of her.
"Let me go,"
she said, yanking away from him.
"I'm going to tell them that Regal and I are in love with each other, and if he survives your vicious..."
"Sit down," he said. "Be quiet."
And then he thought again of Regal not being around to work tomorrow's puzzle. Panic got started in him then and began to control him.
"I feel like getting into the closet," he told his wife.
"No," he said.
"I feel like burrowing down into the floor, down into the ground." "Infantile guilt," Junie said with derision.
Bill Black said,
"Fear, plain fear."
"You're ashamed."
"No," he said. "Infantile fear, adult fear."
"Adult fear?" Junie snorted. "There's no such thing."
"Yes, there is," he said.
Garrett laid a folded fresh bath towel on the arm of the chair and, with it, a wash rag and a bar of soap in its wrapper.
"You'll have to get along without pajamas," he said. "The bathroom is through this door."
He opened a door and Regal saw down a narrow corridor, like a ship's passage, to a cramped closet-like bathroom at the far end.
"Fine," Regal said. The liquor had made him sleepy.
"Thanks," he said.
"I'll see you tomorrow."
"There's plenty of books and magazines in the rumpus room itself," Garrett said. "If you can't sleep and want to read. And there's a chess set and other games. None for one person, though."
He departed. Regal heard his footsteps as he climbed the stairs to the first floor. The door at the top of the flight of stairs closed. Sitting down on the bed, Regal tugged his shoes off and let them drop to the floor. Then he caught hold of them with a finger in each, hoisted them high, and searched for a place to put them. He noticed a shelf running along the wall. On the shelf was a lamp, a wind-up clock, and a small white plastic radio. As soon as he saw the radio, he put his shoes back on, buttoned up his shirt, and dashed out of the room to the stairs. They almost fooled me, but they gave themselves away. He ascended two steps at a time and pushed open the door at the top. Only a minute or so had passed since Garrett Kesselman had preceded him. Regal stood in the hallway, listening. From a distance came the sounds of Mrs. Kesselman's voice. She's getting in touch with them, calling them on the phone or broadcasting to them, one way or another. With as little noise as possible, he moved along the hall in the direction of her voice. The hall, dark, ended at a half-open door. Light streamed out into the hall, and as he got near, he saw into a dining room. Wearing a robe and slippers, her hair up in a turban, Mrs. Kesselman was feeding a small black dog from a dish on the floor. Both she and the dog started with surprise as Regal pushed the door open. The dog backed away and began to bark in a rapid staccato. "Oh!" Mrs. Kesselman said. "You scared me." In her hands, she held a box of dog biscuits. "Did you need something?" Regal said, "There's a radio downstairs in my room." "Yes?" she said. "That's how they communicate," Regal said.
"Who?"
"They," he said. "I don't know who they are, but they're all around me. They're the ones who are after me. And," he thought, "you and your son are two of them. You almost had me. Too bad you forgot to hide the radio. But probably you didn't have time." From the hallway, Garrett appeared.
"Everything okay?"
he asked in a worried voice.
To him, his mother said, "Dear, close the door so I can talk to Mr. Gum alone, will you?"
"I want him in here," Regal said. He moved toward Garrett, who blinked and backed away, his arms flapping helplessly. Closing the door, Regal said, "There's no way I can tell if you've called to say I'm here. I'll have to take the chance that you haven't had time." I don't know where else to go, he thought. Certainly not tonight.
"Now, what's this about?" Mrs. Kesselman said.
Stooping down, she resumed the feeding of the dog. The dog, after a few more barks at Regal, returned to his food.
"You're being pursued by a group of people, and you say we're part of that group? Then that business about your committing suicide is something you made up."
"I made it up," he agreed.
"Why are they pursuing you?" Garrett said.
Regal said, "Because I'm the center of the universe. At least that's what I've inferred from their actions. They act as if I am. I only have that to go on. They've gone to a great deal of trouble to construct a sham world around me to keep me pacified. Buildings, cars, and an entire town. Natural-looking, but completely unreal. The part I don't understand is the contest."
"Oh," Mrs. Kesselman said. "Your contest."
"Evidently it plays a vital role with them," Regal said. "But I'm baffled. Do you know?"
"I don't know any more than you do," Mrs. Kesselman said. "Of course, we always hear that these big contests are rigged, but except for the usual rumors..."
"I mean," Regal said, "do you know what the contest really is?" Neither of them spoke. Mrs. Kesselman, her back to him, continued feeding the dog. Garrett sat down on a chair and crossed his legs, leaning back with his hands wrapped behind his head, trying to appear calm. "Do you know what I'm really doing every day?" Regal said. "When I'm supposedly plotting where the little green man will show up next? I must be doing something else. They know, but I don't." Both the Kesselmans were silent. "Had you called?" Regal asked them. Garrett quivered with embarrassment. Mrs. Kesselman seemed shaken, but she continued to feed the dog. "Can I look through the house?" Regal said.
"Surely," Mrs. Kesselman said, straightening up. "Look, Mr. Gum, we're doing the best we can to accommodate you, but..."
With a wild gesture, she burst out,
"Honestly, you've got us both so upset we hardly know what we're doing. We never saw you before in our lives. Are you crazy? Is that it? Maybe you are. You certainly are acting as if you are. I wish now you hadn't come here. I wish..."
She hesitated.
"Well, I started to say I wished you'd gone off the road with your car. It isn't fair to us to cause us all this trouble.
That's right, Garrett murmured.
Am I making a mistake? Regal asked himself.
Explain the radio, he said aloud.
There's nothing to explain, Mrs. Kesselman said. It's an ordinary five-tube radio that we got right after World War II. It's been down there for years. I don't even know if it works.
Now she seemed angry. Her hands trembled and her face had become strained, pinched with fatigue.
Everybody owns a radio. Two or three of them.
Regal opened each of the doors that led off the dining room. One of them opened onto a storage closet with shelves and bins. He said,
I want to look around the house. Get in here so I won't have to worry about what you're doing while I look.
In the lock, there was a key.
Please,
Mrs. Kesselman began, glaring at him and almost inarticulate.
Just for a few minutes, he said.
They glanced at each other. Mrs. Kesselman made a sign of resignation, and then they walked wordlessly into the closet. Regal closed it and threw the bolt. He put the key in his pocket.
Now he felt better.
At its dish, the black dog watched him intently.
Why is it watching me? He wondered.
And then he noticed that the dog had finished its food and was hoping that he would give it more. The package remained on the long dinner table where Mrs. Kesselman had left it. He sprinkled a few more dog biscuits into the dish and the dog fell to eating again. From within the closet, Garrett's voice was distinctly audible.
Face it! He's a nut!
Regal said,
I'm not a nut. I've watched this thing grow step by step. At least I've become aware of it step by step.
Mrs. Kesselman said to him through the closet door,
Look, Mr. Gum, it's clear to us that you believe what you say. But don't you see what you're doing? Because you believe everyone's against you, you force everyone to be against you.
Like ourselves, Garrett said. There was a lot in what they said. Regal, uncertainly, said,
I can't take any chances.
You have to take a chance with someone, Mrs. Kesselman said, or you can't live.
Regal said,
I'll look through the house and then I'll make up my mind.
The woman's voice, controlled and civilized, went on.
At least call your family and tell them you're all right, so they won't worry about you. They're probably quite upset.
You should let us call them, Garrett said.
So they wouldn't phone the police or something.
Regal left the dining room. First he inspected the living room. Nothing seemed out of order. What did he intend to find? The same old problem. He wouldn't know until he found it, and perhaps even then he wouldn't be sure. On the wall, beyond a small spinet piano, hung a telephone, a bright pink plastic phone with a curly plastic cord, and upright in the bookcase, the phone book. He lifted the book out. It was the same phone book as the one Sammy had found in the vacant lot. He opened it. Written in pencil, red crayon, ballpoint pen, and fountain pen were numbers and names on the blank first page, addresses, jotted notations of dates, times, events. The current phone book, in use in this house by these people. Walnut, Sherman, Kentfield, Devonshire numbers. The number on the phone itself was a Kentfield number. So that settled that. Carrying the book, he strode back through the house, into the dining room. He got out the key and unlocked the closet door, swinging it wide. The closet was empty. A large hole had been neatly cut in the rear wall, a still warm rim of wood and plaster through which showed one of the bedrooms. They had cut a passage out in a matter of minutes. On the floor, by the hole, lay two tiny drill-like points. One had been bent, damaged, and scored. The wrong size. Too small. And the other, probably not tried. They had found the right size and finished the job, scrambled out in such haste that they had forgotten these parts of the cutting tool. Holding the drill-like points in the palm of his hand, he saw that they were like nothing he had ever seen before. In all his life. While they had talked reasonably and rationally, they had been cutting through the back wall.
I'm hopelessly outclassed, he said to himself. I might as well give up.
He made a cursory tour of the house. No sign of them. The back door banged open and shut in the late evening wind. They had gone outside, left the house entirely. He sensed the emptiness of the house. Only he and the dog. Not even the dog. There was no sign of it now. The dog had gone with them. He could plunge out onto the road. Possibly somewhere in the house was a flashlight he could take. There might even be a heavy coat he could wear. With luck, he could march a good distance before the Kesselmans had time to return with support. He could hide in the woods, wait until daylight, try to reach the highway, try to hike all the way to the bottom of the hill, however many miles it was. What a dismal prospect. He shrank from it. He needed rest and sleep, not more walking. Or he could stay in the house, and in the time left to him, explore it as fully as possible. Learn as much as he could before they got him in tow again. The latter appealed to him, if it had to be one or the other. He returned to the living room. This time he opened drawers and cupboards and poked into the ordinary objects, such as the television set in the corner. On top of the television set, mounted in a mahogany frame, was a tape recorder. He snapped the switch, and a reel of tape already on the mechanism began to move. After a moment or so, the screen of the television set lit up. The tape, he realized, was for video use as well as audio. Standing back, he watched the screen. On the television screen appeared Regal Gum, first a front view and then a side view. Regal Gum strolled along a tree-lined residential street, past parked cars, lawns. Then a close-up of him, full face. From the speaker of the TV set, a voice said, "This is Regal Gum." On the screen, Regal Gum now sat in a deck chair in the backyard of a house, wearing a Hawaiian sport shirt and shorts. "You will hear an excerpt of his conversational manner," the voice from the speaker said. And then Regal heard his own voice. "Get home ahead of you. I'll do it," Regal Gum said. "Otherwise, you can do it tomorrow. Is that okay?" "They have me down in black and white," Regal thought. "In color, as a matter of fact." He stopped the tape. The image remained inert. Then he clicked the switch off, and the image dwindled to a spot of brightness and at last vanished entirely. "No wonder everybody recognizes me. They've been trained. When I start to imagine I'm crazy, I'll remember this tape machine, this training program of identification with me as the topic. I wonder how many tapes like this are sitting in how many machines and how many homes, over how large an area. Every house that I ever passed, every street, every town, perhaps. The entire earth?" He heard, from far off, the noise of an engine. It started him into motion. Not long, he realized. He opened the front door and the noise increased. In the darkness below him, twin lights flashed and then were temporarily broken off. "But what is it for?" he wondered. "Who are they? What are things really like? I've got to see." Running through the house, he passed one object after another, from one room to the next. Furnishings, books, food in the kitchen, personal articles in drawers, clothes hanging in closets. What would tell him the most? At the back porch, he stopped. He had reached the end of the house. A washing machine, mop hanging from a rack, package of Dash soap, a stack of magazines and newspapers. Reaching into the stack, he dragged out a handful, dropping them, opening them at random. The date on a newspaper made him stop searching. He stood holding it. May 10th, 1997. Almost 40 years in the future. His eyes took in the headlines. Meaningless jumble of isolated trivia. A murder. Bond issue to raise funds for parking lots. Death of famous scientist. Revolt in Argentina. And, near the bottom, the headline, "Venusian ore deposits, object of dispute." Litigation in the international system of courts concerning the ownership of property on Venus,
He read as rapidly as he could, and then he tossed the newspaper down and pawed through the magazines. A copy of Time, dated April 7th, 1997. Rolling it up, he stuck it in his trouser pocket. More copies of Time. He rooted through them, opening them and trying to devour the articles all at once, trying to grasp and retain something. Fashions, bridges, paintings, medicine, ice hockey, everything. The world of the future laid out in careful prose. Concise summaries of each branch of the society that had not yet come into existence. That had come into existence. That existed now. This was a current magazine. This was the year 1997, not 1959. From the road outside, the noise of a vehicle stopping caused him to grab up the rest of the magazines. An armload. He started to open the back door to the yard outside. Voices. In the yard, men moved. A light flashed. His armload of magazines struck the door, and most of them tumbled to the porch. Kneeling down, he gathered them up.
"There he is!"
a voice said, and the light flicked in his direction, dazzling him. He swung so that his back was to it. Lifting up one of the copies of Time, he stared at the cover. On the cover of Time, dated January 14, 1996, was his picture, a painting in color, with the words underneath it, "Regal Gum, Man of the Year." Sitting down on the porch, he opened the magazine and found the article. Photographs of him as a baby, his mother and father, him as a child in grammar school. He turned the pages frantically. Him as he was now, after World War II or whatever war it had been that he had fought in. Military uniform, himself smiling back at the camera. A woman who was his first wife. And then a scenic sprawl, the sharp city-like spires and minarets of an industrial installation. The magazine was plucked from his hands. He looked up and saw, to his amazement, that the men lifting him up and away from the porch had on familiar drab coveralls.
"Watch out for that gate,"
one of them said. He glimpsed dark trees, men stepping on flower beds, crushing plants under their shoes, flashlights swinging across the stone path out of the yard to the road. And in the road, trucks parked with their motors noisily running, headlights on. Olive-green service trucks, 1.5 tons. Familiar, too. Like the drab coveralls. City trucks. City maintenance men. And then one of the men held something to his face. A bubble of plastic that the man compressed with his fingers. The bubble split apart and became fumes. Held between four of the men, Regal Gum could do nothing but breathe in the fumes. A flashlight poured yellow fumes and glare into his face. He shut his eyes.
"Don't hurt him,"
a voice murmured.
"Be careful with him."
Under him, the metal of the truck had a cold, damp quality. As if, he thought, he had been loaded in a refrigerator tank. Produce from the countryside to be hauled into town, to be ready for the next day's market.